circumcision. It has been argued that the process is more hygienic for the male and thus more healthy for females in helping them avoid, for example, cervical cancer. Medicine has exploded these claims or else revealed them as problems which can just as easily be solved by a loosening of the foreskin. Full excision, originally ordered by God as the blood price for the promised future massacre of the Canaanites, is now exposed for what it is, a mutilation of a powerless infant with the aim of ruining its future sex life. The connection between religious barbarism and sexual repression could not be plainer than when it is marked in the flesh. Who can count the number of lives that have been made miserable in this way, especially since Christian doctors began to adopt ancient Jewish folklore in their hospitals? And who can bear to read the medical textbooks and histories which calmly record the number of boy babies who died from infection after their eighth day, or who suffered gross and unbearable dysfunction and disfigurement? The record of syphilitic and other infection from rotting rabbinical teeth or other rabbinical indiscretions, or of clumsy slitting of the urethra and sometimes a vein, is simply dreadful. And it is permitted in New York in 2006. If religion and its arrogance were not involved, no healthy society would permit this primitive amputation or allow any surgery to be practiced on the genitalia without the full and informed consent of the person concerned. Religion is also to be blamed for the hideous consequences of the masturbation taboo, which also furnished yet another excuse for circumcision among the Victorians. For decades, millions of young men and boys were terrified in adolescence by supposedly medical advice that warned them of blindness, nervous collapse, and descent into insanity if they resorted to self-gratification. Stern lectures from clergymen, replete with nonsense about semen as an irreplaceable and finite energy source, dominated the upbringing of generations. Robert Baden-Powell composed an entire obsessive treatise on the subject, which he used to reinforce the muscular Christianity of his Boy Scout movement. To this day, the madness persists on Islamic websites purporting to offer counsel to the young. Indeed, it seems that the mullahs have been poring over the same discredited texts by Samuel Tiso and others, which used to be wielded by their Christian predecessors to such dire effect. The identical weird and dirty-minded misinformation is on offer, especially from Abdulaziz bin Baz, the late Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, whose warnings against onanism are repeated on many Muslim sites. The habit will disrupt the digestive system, he warns, damage the eyesight, inflame the testicles, erode the spinal cord, the place from which sperm originates, and lead to tremors and shakes. Nor are the cerebral glands unaffected, with concomitant decline in IQ and eventual insanity. Last of all, and still tormenting millions of healthy youngsters with guilt and worry, the Mufti tells them that their semen will grow thin and insipid and prevent them from becoming fathers later on. The Inter-Islam and Islamic Voice sites recycle this tripe, as if there were not already enough repression and ignorance among young males in the Muslim world, who are often kept apart from all female company, taught in effect to despise their mothers and sisters, and subjected to stultifying rote recitation of the Quran. Having met some of the products of this education system in Afghanistan and elsewhere, I can only reiterate that their problem is not so much that they desire virgins as that they are virgins. Their emotional and psychic growth irremediably stunted in the name of God, and the safety of many others menaced as a consequence of this alienation and deformation. Sexual innocence, which can be charming in the young if it is not needlessly protracted, is positively corrosive and repulsive in the mature adult. Again, how shall we reckon the harm done by dirty old men and hysterical spinsters, appointed as clerical guardians to supervise the innocent in orphanages and schools? The Roman Catholic Church in particular is having to answer this question in the most painful of ways by calculating the monetary value of child abuse in terms of compensation. Billions of dollars have already been awarded, but there is no price to be put on the generations of boys and girls who were introduced to sex in the most alarming and disgusting ways by those whom they and their parents trusted. Child abuse is really a silly and pathetic euphemism for what's been going on. We're talking about the systematic rape and torture of children, positively aided and abetted by a hierarchy which knowingly moved the grossest offenders to parishes where they would be safer. Given what has come to light in modern cities in recent times, one can only shudder to think what was happening in the centuries where the church was above all criticism. But what did people expect would happen when the vulnerable were controlled by those who, misfits and inverts themselves, were required to affirm hypocritical celibacy, and who were taught to state grimly, as an article of belief, that children were imps of or limbs of Satan? Sometimes the resulting frustration expressed itself in horrible excesses of corporal punishment, which is bad enough in itself. But when the artificial inhibitions really collapse, as we have seen them do, they result in behaviour which no average masturbating, fornicating sinner could even begin to contemplate without horror. This is not the result of a few delinquents among the shepherds, but an outcome of an ideology which sought to establish clerical control, by means of control of the sexual instinct and even of the sexual organs. It belongs, like the rest of religion, to the fearful childhood of our species. Alyosha's answer to Ivan's question about the sacred torture of a child was to say, softly, "No, I do not agree." Our reply, to the repellent original offer of the defenceless boy Isaac on the pyre, right up to the current abuses and repressions, must be the same, only not delivered so softly. Chapter 17. An Objection Anticipated. The Last-Ditch Case Against Secularism. If I cannot definitively prove that the usefulness of religion is in the past, and that its foundational books are transparent fables, and that it is a man-made imposition, and that it has been an enemy of science and inquiry, and that it has subsisted largely on lies and fears, and been the accomplice of ignorance and guilt as well as of slavery, genocide, racism, and tyranny, I can most certainly claim that religion is now fully aware of these criticisms. It is also fully aware of the ever-mounting evidence concerning the origins of the cosmos and the origin of species, which consign it to marginality, if not to irrelevance. I have tried to deal with most faith-based objections as they occur in the unfolding argument, but there is one remaining argument that one may not avoid. When the worst has been said about the Inquisition and the witch trials and the Crusades and the Islamic imperial conquests and the horrors of the Old Testament, is it not true that secular and atheist regimes have committed crimes and massacres that are, in the scale of things, at least as bad, if not worse? And does not the corollary hold that men freed from religious awe will act in the most unbridled and abandoned manner? Dostoevsky, in his Brothers Karamazov, was extremely critical of religion and lived under a despotism that was sanctified by the Church, and he also represented his character Smerdyakov as a vain and credulous and stupid figure, but Smerdyakov's maxim that if there is no God, there is no morality, understandably resonates with those who look back on the Russian Revolution through the prism of the 20th century. One could go further and say that secular totalitarianism has actually provided us with the summa of human evil. The examples most in common use, those of the Hitler and Stalin regimes, show us with terrible clarity what can happen when men usurp the role of gods. When I consult with my secular and atheist friends, I find that this has become the most common and frequent objection that they encounter from religious audiences. The point deserves a detailed reply. To begin with a slightly inexpensive observation, it is interesting to find that people of faith now seek defensively to say that they are no worse than fascists or Nazis or Stalinists. One might hope that religion had retained more sense of its dignity than that. I would not say that the ranks of secularism and atheism are exactly crammed with communists or fascists, but it can be granted for the sake of argument that just as secularists and atheists have withstood clerical and theocratic tyrannies, so religious believers have resisted pagan and materialistic ones. But this would only be to split the difference. The word totalitarian was probably first used by the dissident Marxist Victor Serge, who had become appalled by the harvest of Stalinism in the Soviet Union. It was popularized by the secular Jewish intellectual Hannah Arendt, who had fled the hell of the Third Reich and who wrote The Origins of Totalitarianism. It is a useful term because it separates ordinary forms of despotism, those which merely exact obedience from their subjects, from the absolutist systems which demand that citizens become holy subjects and surrender their private lives and personalities entirely to the state or to the supreme leader. If we accept that latter definition, then the first point to be made is likewise an easy one. For most of human history, the idea of the total or absolute state was intimately bound up with religion. A baron or king might compel you to pay taxes or serve in his army, and he would usually arrange to have priests on hand to remind you that this was your duty. But the truly frightening despotisms were those which also wanted the contents of your heart and your head. Whether we examine the Oriental monarchies of China or India or Persia, or the empires of the Aztec or the Incas, or the medieval courts of Spain and Russia and France, it is almost unvaryingly that we find that these dictators were also gods, or the heads of churches. More than mere obedience was owed them. Any criticism of them was profane by definition. And millions of people lived and died in pure fear of a ruler who could select you for a sacrifice, or condemn you to eternal punishment, on a whim. The slightest infringement of a holy day or a holy object, or an ordinance about sex or food or caste, could bring calamity. The totalitarian principle, which is often represented as systematic, is also closely bound up with caprice. The rules might change or be extended at any moment, and the rulers had the advantage of knowing that their subjects could never be sure if they were obeying the latest law or not. We now value the few exceptions from antiquity, such as Periclean Athens with all its deformities, precisely because there were a few moments when humanity did not live in permanent terror of a pharaoh or Nebuchadnezzar or Darius whose least word was holy law. This was even true when the divine right of despots began to give way to versions of modernity. The idea of a utopian state on earth, perhaps modelled on some heavenly ideal, is very hard to efface and has led people to commit terrible crimes in the name of the ideal. One of the very first attempts to create such an ideal Edenic society, patterned on the scheme of human equality, was the totalitarian socialist state established by the Jesuit missionaries in Paraguay. It managed to combine the maximum of egalitarianism with the maximum of unfreedom, and could only be kept going by the maximum of fear. This ought to have been a warning to those who sought to perfect the human species. Yet the object of perfecting the species, which is the very root and source of the totalitarian impulse, is in essence a religious one. George Orwell, the ascetic unbeliever, whose novels gave us an ineradicable picture of what life in a totalitarian state might truly feel like, was in no doubt about this. From the totalitarian point of view, he wrote in The Prevention of Literature in 1946, history is something to be created rather than learned. A totalitarian state is in effect a theocracy, and its ruling caste, in order to keep its position, has to be thought of as infallible. You will notice that he wrote this in a year when, having fought for more than a decade against fascism, he was turning his guns even more on the sympathizers of communism. In order to be a part of the totalitarian mindset, it is not necessary to wear a uniform or carry a club or a whip. It is only necessary to wish for your own subjection and to delight in the subjection of others. What is a totalitarian system if not one where the abject glorification of the perfect leader is matched by the surrender of all privacy and individuality, especially in matters sexual, and in denunciation and punishment, for their own good, of those who transgress? The sexual element is probably decisive, in that the dullest mind can grasp what Nathaniel Hawthorne captured in The Scarlet Letter, the deep connection between repression and perversion. In the early history of mankind, the totalitarian principle was the regnant one. The state religion supplied a complete and total answer to all questions, from one's position in the social hierarchy to the rules governing diet and sex. Slave or not, the human was property, and the clerisy was the reinforcement of absolutism. Orwell's most imaginative projection of the totalitarian idea, the offensive thought crime, was a commonplace. An impure thought, let alone a heretical one, could lead to your being flayed alive. To be accused of demonic possession or contact with the evil one was to be convicted of it. Orwell's first realization of the hellishness of this came to him early in life, when he was enclosed in a hermetic school run by Christian sadists, in which it was not possible to know when you had broken the rules. Whatever you did, and however many precautions you took, the sins of which you were unaware could always be made to find you out. It was possible to leave that awful school, traumatized for life, as millions of children have been, but it is not possible, in the religious totalitarian vision, to escape this world of original sin and guilt and pain. An infinity of punishment awaits you even after you die. According to the really extreme religious totalitarians, such as John Calvin, who borrowed his awful doctrine from Augustine, an infinity of punishment can be awaiting you even before you were born. Long ago it was written which souls would be chosen or elected when the time came to divide the sheep from the goats. No appeal against this primordial sentence is possible, and no good works or professions of faith can save one who has not been fortunate enough to be picked. Calvin's Geneva was a prototypical totalitarian state, and Calvin himself a sadist and torturer and killer, who burned Servetus, one of the great thinkers and questioners of the day, while the man was still alive. The lesser wretchedness induced in Calvin's followers, compelled to waste their lives worrying if they'd been elected or not, is well caught in George Eliot's Adam Bede and in an old English plebeian satire against the other sects, from Jehovah's Witnesses to Plymouth Brethren, who dare to claim that they are of the elect, and that they alone know the exact number of those who will be plucked from the burning. We are the pure and chosen few, and all the rest are damned. There's room enough in hell for you. We don't want heaven crammed. I had an innocuous but weak-spirited uncle whose life was ruined and made miserable in just this way. Calvin may seem like a far-off figure to us, but those who used to grab and use power in his name are still among us and go by the softer names of Presbyterians and Baptists. The urge to ban and censor books, silence dissenters, condemn outsiders, invade the private sphere, and invoke an exclusive salvation is the very essence of the totalitarian. The fatalism of Islam, which believes that all is arranged by Allah in advance, has some points of resemblance in its utter denial of human autonomy and liberty, as well as in its arrogant and insufferable belief that its faith already contains everything that anyone might ever need to know. Thus, when the great anti-totalitarian anthology of the 20th century came to be published in 1950, its two editors realized that it could only have one possible name. They called it The God That Failed. I slightly knew and sometimes worked for one of these two men, the British socialist Richard Crossman, as he wrote in his introduction to the book. For the intellectual, material comforts are relatively unimportant. What he cares about most is spiritual freedom. The strength of the Catholic Church has always been that it demands the sacrifice of that freedom uncompromisingly and condemns spiritual pride as a deadly sin. The communist novice, subjecting his soul to the canon law of the Kremlin, felt something of the release which Catholicism also brings to the intellectual, wearied and worried by the privilege of freedom. The only book that had warned of all this in advance, a full 30 years earlier, was a small but brilliant volume published in 1919 and entitled The Practice and Theory of Bolshevism. Long before Arthur Koestler and Richard Crossman had begun to survey the wreckage in retrospect, the whole disaster was being predicted in terms that still command admiration for their prescience. The mordant analyst of the new religion was Bertrand Russell, whose atheism made him more far-seeing than many naive Christian socialists who claimed to detect in Russia the beginnings of a new paradise on earth. He was also more far-seeing than the Anglican Christian establishment in his native England, whose newspaper of record, the London Times, took the view that the Russian Revolution could be explained by the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. This revolting fabrication by Russian Orthodox secret policemen was republished by Eyre and Spottiswood, the official printers to the Church of England. Given its own record of succumbing to and of promulgating dictatorship on earth and absolute control in the life to come, how did religion confront the secular totalitarians of our time? One should first consider in order fascism, Nazism, and Stalinism. Fascism, the precursor and model of National Socialism, was a movement that believed in an organic and corporate society presided over by a leader or guide. The fasces, symbol of the lictors or enforcers of ancient Rome, were a bundle of rods tied around an axe that stood for unity and authority. Arising out of the misery and humiliation of the First World War, fascist movements were in favor of the defense of traditional values against Bolshevism and upheld nationalism and piety. It is probably not a coincidence that they arose first and most excitedly in Catholic countries, and it is certainly not a coincidence that the Catholic Church was generally sympathetic to fascism as an idea. Not only did the Church regard communism as a lethal foe, but it also saw its old Jewish enemy in the most senior ranks of Lenin's party. Benito Mussolini had barely seized power in Italy before the Vatican made an official treaty with him, known as the Lateran Pact of 1929. Under the terms of this deal, Catholicism became the only recognized religion in Italy, with monopoly powers over matters such as birth, marriage, death, and education, and in return urged its followers to vote for Mussolini's party. Pope Pius XI described Il Duce, the leader, as a man sent by Providence. Elections were not to be a feature of Italian life for very long, but the Church nonetheless brought about the dissolution of lay Catholic centrist parties and helped sponsor a pseudo-party called Catholic Action, which was emulated in several countries. Across southern Europe, the Church was a reliable ally in the instatement of fascist regimes in Spain, Portugal, and Croatia. General Franco in Spain was allowed to call his invasion of the country and his destruction of its elected republic by the honorific title La Crujada, or the Crusade. The Vatican either supported or refused to criticize Mussolini's operatic attempt to recreate a pastiche of the Roman Empire by his invasions of Libya, Abyssinia, today's Ethiopia, and Albania, these territories being populated either by non-Christians or by the wrong kind of Eastern Christian. Mussolini even gave, as one of his justifications for the use of poison gas and other gruesome measures in Abyssinia, the persistence of its inhabitants in the heresy of monophysitism, an incorrect dogma of the Incarnation that had been condemned by Pope Leo and the Council of Chalcedon in the year 451. In Central and Eastern Europe, the picture was hardly better. The extreme right-wing military coup in Hungary, led by Admiral Horthy, was warmly endorsed by the Church, as were similar fascistic movements in Slovakia and Austria. The Nazi puppet regime in Slovakia was actually led by a man in holy orders named Father Tiso. The Cardinal of Austria proclaimed his enthusiasm at Hitler's takeover of his country at the time of the Anschluss. In France, the extreme right adopted the slogan of Meilleur Hitler que Blum, in other words, better to have a German racist dictator than an elected French socialist Jew. Catholic fascist organizations such as Charles Maurras's Action Française and the Croix de Feu campaigned violently against French democracy and made no bones about their grievance, which was the way in which France had been going downhill since the acquittal of the Jewish captain Alfred Dreyfus in 1899. When the German conquest of France arrived, these forces eagerly collaborated in the rounding up and murder of French Jews, as well as in the deportation to forced labor of a huge number of other Frenchmen. The Vichy regime conceded to clericalism by wiping the slogan of 1789, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, off the national currency and replacing it with the Christian ideal motto of Famille, Travail, Patrie. Even in a country like England, where fascist sympathies were far less prevalent, they still managed to get an audience in respectable circles by the agency of Catholic intellectuals such as T.S. Eliot and Evelyn Waugh. In neighbouring Ireland, the Blue Shirt movement of General O'Duffy, which sent volunteers to fight for Franco in Spain, was little more than a dependency of the Catholic Church. As late as April 1945, on the news of the death of Hitler, President Eamon de Valera put on his top hat, called for the state coach, and went to the German embassy in Dublin to offer his official condolences. Attitudes like this meant that several Catholic-dominated states, from Ireland to Spain to Portugal, were ineligible to join the United Nations when it was first founded. The Church has made efforts to apologize for all this, but its complicity with fascism is an ineffaceable mark on its history, and was not a short-term or a hasty commitment, so much as a working alliance which did not break down until after the fascist period had itself passed into history. The case of the Church's surrender to German National Socialism is considerably more complicated, but not very much more elevating. Despite sharing two important principles with Hitler's movement, those of anti-Semitism and anti-communism, the Vatican could see that Nazism represented a challenge to itself as well. In the first place, it was a quasi-pagan phenomenon, which in the long run sought to replace Christianity with pseudo-Nordic blood rites and sinister race myths based upon the fantasy of Aryan superiority. In the second place, it advocated an exterminationist attitude to the unwell, the unfit, and the insane, and began quite early on to apply this policy not to Jews but to Germans. To the credit of the Church, it must be said that its German pulpits denounced this hideous eugenic culling from a very early date. But if ethical principle had been the guide, the Vatican would not have had to spend the next 50 years vainly trying to account for, or apologize for, its contemptible passivity and inaction. Passivity and inaction, in fact, may be the wrong choice of words here. To decide to do nothing is itself a policy and a decision, and it is unfortunately easy to record and explain the Church's alignment in terms of a realpolitik that sought not the defeat of Nazism, but an accommodation with it. The very first diplomatic accord undertaken by Hitler's government was consummated on July 8, 1933, a few months after the seizure of power, and took the form of a treaty with the Vatican. In return for unchallenged control of the education of Catholic children in Germany, the dropping of Nazi propaganda against the abuses inflicted in Catholic schools and orphanages, and the concession of other privileges to the Church, the Holy See instructed the Catholic Center Party to disband and brusquely ordered German Catholics to abstain from any political activity on any subject that the regime chose to define as off-limits. At the first meeting of his cabinet after this capitulation was signed, Hitler announced that these new circumstances would be especially significant in the struggle against international Jewry. He was not wrong about this. In fact, he could have been excused for disbelieving his own luck. The 23 million Catholics living in the Third Reich, many of whom had shown great individual courage in resisting the rise of Nazism, had been gutted and gelded as a political force. Their own Holy Father had, in effect, told them to render everything unto the worst Caesar in human history. From then on, parish records were made available to the Nazi state in order to establish who was and who was not racially pure enough to survive endless persecution under the Nuremberg laws. Not the least appalling consequence of this moral surrender was the parallel moral collapse of the German Protestants. who sought to preempt a special status for Catholics by publishing their own accommodation with the Führer. None of the Protestant churches, however, went as far as the Catholic hierarchy in ordering an annual celebration for Hitler's birthday on April the 20th. On this auspicious date, on papal instructions, the Cardinal of Berlin regularly transmitted warmest congratulations to the Führer in the name of the bishops and dioceses of Germany. These plaudits to be accompanied by the fervent prayers which the Catholics of Germany are sending to heaven on their altars. The order was obeyed and faithfully carried out. To be fair, this disgraceful tradition was not inaugurated until 1939, in which year there was a change of papacy. And to be fair again, Pope Pius XI had always harboured the most profound misgivings about the Hitler system and its evident capacity for radical evil. During Hitler's first visit to Rome, for example, the Holy Father rather ostentatiously took himself out of town to the papal retreat at Castel Gandolfo. However, this ailing and weak pope was continually outpointed throughout the 1930s by his Secretary of State, Eugenio Pacelli. We have good reason to think that at least one papal encyclical, expressing at least a modicum of concern about the maltreatment of Europe's Jews, was readied by His Holiness but suppressed by Pacelli, who had another strategy in mind. We now know Pacelli as Pope Pius XII, who succeeded to the office after the death of his former superior in February 1939. 4 days after his election by the College of Cardinals, His Holiness composed the following letter to Berlin. To the illustrious Herr Adolf Hitler, Führer and Chancellor of the German Reich. Here at the beginning of our pontificate, we wish to assure you that we remain devoted to the spiritual welfare of the German people entrusted to your leadership. During the many years we spent in Germany, we did all in our power to establish harmonious relations between church and state. Now that the responsibilities of our pastoral function have increased our opportunities, how much more ardently do we pray to reach that goal? May the prosperity of the German people and their progress in every domain come, with God's help, to fruition. Within 6 years of this evil and fatuous message, the once prosperous and civilized people of Germany could gaze around themselves and see hardly one brick piled upon another, as the godless Red Army swept toward Berlin. But I mention this conjuncture for another reason. Believers are supposed to hold that the Pope is the Vicar of Christ on earth and the keeper of the keys of St. Peter. They are, of course, free to believe this and to believe that God decides when to end the tenure of one pope or, more important, to inaugurate the tenure of another. This would involve believing in the death of an anti-Nazi pope and the accession of a pro-Nazi one as a matter of divine will a few months before Hitler's invasion of Poland and the opening of the Second World War. Studying that war, one can perhaps accept that 25% of the SS were practicing Catholics and that no Catholic was ever even threatened with excommunication for participating in war crimes. Joseph Goebbels was excommunicated, but that was earlier on, and he had, after all, brought it on himself for the offence of marrying a Protestant. Human beings and institutions are imperfect, to be sure, but there could be no clearer or more vivid proof that holy institutions are man-made. The collusion continued even after the war, as wanted Nazi criminals were spirited to South America by the infamous Rat Line. It was the Vatican itself, with its ability to provide passports, documents, money and contacts, which organised the escape network, and also the necessary shelter and succour at the other end. Bad as this was in itself, it also involved another collaboration with extreme-right dictatorships in the Southern Hemisphere, many of them organised on the fascist model. Fugitive torturers and murderers like Klaus Barbie often found themselves second careers as servants of these regimes, which until they began to collapse in the last decades of the 20th century, had also enjoyed a steady relationship of support from the local Catholic clergy. The connection of the Church to fascism and Nazism actually outlasted the Third Reich itself. Many Christians gave their lives to protect their fellow creatures in this midnight of the century, but the chance that they did so on orders from any priesthood is statistically almost negligible. This is why we revere the memory of the very few believers, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Niemöller, who acted in accordance only with the dictates of conscience. The papacy took until the 1980s to find a candidate for sainthood in the context of the final solution, and even then could only identify a rather ambivalent priest who, after a long record of political antisemitism in Poland, had apparently behaved nobly in Auschwitz. An earlier nominee, a simple Austrian named Franz Jägerstätter, was unfortunately unqualified. He had indeed refused to join Hitler's army on the grounds that he was under higher orders to love his neighbour, but while in prison facing execution had been visited by his confessors, who told him that he ought to be obeying the law. The secular left in Europe comes far better out of the anti-Nazi struggle than that, even if many of its adherents believed that there was a workers' paradise beyond the Ural Mountains. It is often forgotten that the Axis triad included another member, the Empire of Japan, which had not only a religious person as its head of state, but an actual deity. If the appalling heresy of believing that Emperor Hirohito was God was ever denounced from any German or Italian pulpit or by any prelate, I have been unable to discover the fact. In the sacred name of this ridiculously overrated mammal, huge areas of China and Indochina in the Pacific were plundered and enslaved. In his name, too, millions of indoctrinated Japanese were martyred and sacrificed. So imposing and hysterical was the cult of this god-king that it was believed that the whole Japanese people might resort to suicide if his person was threatened at the end of the war. It was accordingly decided that he could stay on, but that he would henceforward have to claim to be an emperor only, and perhaps somewhat divine, but not strictly speaking a god. This deference to the strength of religious opinion must involve the admission that faith and worship can make people behave very badly indeed. Thus, those who invoke secular tyranny in contrast to religion are hoping that we will forget two things: the connection between the Christian churches and fascism, and the capitulation of the churches to National Socialism. This is not just my assertion. It has been admitted by the religious authorities themselves. Their poor conscience on the point is illustrated by a piece of bad faith that one still has to combat. On religious websites and in religious propaganda, you may come across a statement purportedly made by Albert Einstein in 1940. Being a lover of freedom, when the revolution came to Germany, I looked to the universities to defend it, knowing that they had always boasted of their devotion to the cause of truth. But no, the universities immediately were silenced. Then I looked to the great editors of the newspapers, whose flaming editorials in days gone by had proclaimed their love of freedom. But they, like the universities, were silenced in a few short weeks. Only the church stood squarely across the path of Hitler's campaign for suppressing truth. I never had any special interest in the church before, but now I feel a great affection and admiration because the church alone has had the courage and persistence to stand for intellectual truth and moral freedom. I am forced thus to confess that what I once despised, I now praise unreservedly. Originally printed in Time magazine without any verifiable attribution, this supposed statement was once cited in a national broadcast by the famous American Catholic spokesman and cleric Fulton Sheen, and remains in circulation. As the analyst William Waterhouse has pointed out, it does not sound like Einstein at all. Its rhetoric is too florid, for one thing. It makes no mention of the persecution of the Jews, and it makes the cool and careful Einstein look silly, in that he claims to have once despised something in which he also never had any special interest. There is another difficulty, in that the statement never appears in any anthology of Einstein's written or spoken remarks. Eventually, Waterhouse was able to find an unpublished letter in the Einstein archives in Jerusalem, in which the old man, in 1947, complained of having once made a remark praising some German churchmen, not churches, which had since been exaggerated beyond all recognition. Anyone wanting to know what Einstein did say in the early days of Hitler's barbarism can easily look him up. For example, "I hope that healthy conditions will soon supervene in Germany, and that in future her great men like Kant and Goethe will not merely be commemorated from time to time, but that the principles which they taught will also prevail in public life and in the general consciousness." It is quite clear from this that he put his faith, as always, in the Enlightenment tradition. Those who seek to misrepresent the man who gave us an alternative theory of the cosmos, as well as those who remained silent or worse while his fellow Jews were being deported and destroyed, betray the prickings of their bad consciences. Turning to Soviet and Chinese Stalinism, with its exorbitant cult of personality and depraved indifference to human life and human rights, one cannot expect to find too much overlap with pre-existing religions. For one thing, the Russian Orthodox Church had been the main prop of the Tsarist autocracy, while the Tsar himself was regarded as the formal head of the faith and something a little more than merely human. In China, the Christian churches were overwhelmingly identified with the foreign concessions extracted by imperial powers, which were among the principal causes of the revolution in the first place. This is not to explain or excuse the killing of priests and nuns and the desecration of churches any more than one should excuse the burning of churches and the murder of clergy in Spain during the struggle of the Spanish Republic against Catholic fascism. But the long association of religion with corrupt secular power has meant that most nations have to go through at least one anti-clerical phase from Cromwell through Henry VIII to the French Revolution to the Risorgimento. And in the conditions of warfare and collapse that obtained in Russia and China, these interludes were exceptionally brutal ones. I might add, though, that no serious Christian ought to hope for the restoration of religion as it was in either country. The church in Russia was the protector of serfdom and the author of anti-Jewish pogroms, and in China the missionary and the tight-fisted trader and concessionaire were partners in crime. Lenin and Trotsky were certainly convinced atheists, who believed that illusions in religion could be destroyed by acts of policy, and that in the meantime the obscenely rich holdings of the church could be seized and nationalized. In the Bolshevik ranks, as among the Jacobins of 1789, there were also those who saw the revolution as a sort of alternative religion, with connections to myths of redemption and messianism. For Joseph Stalin, who had trained to be a priest in a seminary in Georgia, the whole thing was ultimately a question of power. How many divisions, he famously and stupidly inquired, has the Pope? The true answer to this boorish sarcasm was, more than you think. Stalin then pedantically repeated the papal routine of making science conform to dogma by insisting that the shaman and charlatan Trofim Lysenko had disclosed the key to genetics and promised extra harvests of specially inspired vegetables. Millions of innocents died of gnawing internal pain as a consequence of this revelation. This Caesar, under whom all things were dutifully rendered, took care, as his regime became a more nationalist and statist one, to maintain at least a puppet church that could attach its traditional appeal to his. This was especially true during the Second World War, when the Internationale was dropped as the Russian anthem and replaced by the sort of hymnal propaganda that had defeated Bonaparte in 1812. This at a time when volunteers from several European fascist states were invading Russian territory under the holy banner of a crusade against godless communism. In a much-neglected passage of Animal Farm, Orwell allowed Moses the Raven, long the croaking advocate of a heaven beyond the skies, to return to the farm and preach to the more credulous creatures after Napoleon had vanquished Snowball. His analogy to Stalin's manipulation of the Russian Orthodox Church was, as ever, quite exact. The post-war Polish Stalinists had recourse to much the same tactic, legalizing a Catholic front organization called Pax Christi and giving it seats in the Warsaw Parliament, much to the delight of fellow traveling Catholic communists such as Graham Greene. Anti-religious propaganda in the Soviet Union was of the most banal materialist sort. A shrine to Lenin often had stained glass, while in the official Museum of Atheism there was testimony offered by a Russian astronaut who had seen no god in outer space. This idiocy expressed at least as much contempt for the gullible yokels as any wonder-working icon. As the great laureate of Poland, Czesław Miłosz, phrased it in his anti-totalitarian classic, The Captive Mind, first published in 1953, I have known many Christians, Poles, Frenchmen, Spaniards, who were strict Stalinists in the field of politics, but who retained certain inner reservations, believing God would make corrections once the bloody sentences of the almighties of history were carried out. They pushed their reasoning rather far. They argue that history develops according to immutable laws that exist by the will of God. One of these laws is the class struggle. The 20th century marks the victory of the proletariat, which is led in its struggle by the Communist Party. Stalin, the leader of the Communist Party, fulfills the law of history, or in other words, acts by the will of God, therefore one must obey him. Mankind can be renewed only on the Russian pattern. That is why no Christian can oppose the one, cruel it is true, idea, which will create a new kind of man over the entire planet. Such reasoning is often used by clerics who are party tools. Christ is a new man. The new man is the Soviet man. Therefore Christ is a Soviet man, said Justinian Marina, the Romanian patriarch. Men like Marina were hateful and pathetic, no doubt, and hateful and pathetic simultaneously. But this is no worse in principle than the numberless pacts made between church and empire, church and monarchy, church and fascism, and church and state, all of them justified by the need of the faithful to make temporal alliances for the sake of higher goals, while rendering unto Caesar the word from which Tsar is derived, even if he is godless. A political scientist or anthropologist would have little difficulty in recognizing what the editors and contributors of The God That Failed put into such immortal secular prose. Communist absolutists did not so much negate religion, in societies that they well understood were saturated with faith and superstition, as seek to replace it. The solemn elevation of infallible leaders who were a source of endless bounty and blessing, the permanent search for heretics and schismatics, the mummification of dead leaders as icons and relics, the lurid show trials that elicited incredible confessions by means of torture, none of this was very difficult to interpret in traditional terms. Nor was the hysteria during times of plague and famine, when the authorities unleashed a mad search for any culprit but the real one. The great Doris Lessing once told me that she left the Communist Party when she discovered that Stalin's inquisitors had plundered the museums of Russian Orthodoxy and Tsarism and re-employed the old instruments of torture. Nor was the ceaseless invocation of a radiant future, the arrival of which would one day justify all crimes and dissolve all petty doubts. Extra ecclesiam nulla salus, as the older faith used to say. Within the revolution, anything, as Fidel Castro was fond of remarking. Outside the revolution, nothing. Indeed, within Castro's periphery, there evolved a bizarre mutation, known oxymoronically as liberation theology, where priests and even some bishops adopted alternative liturgies, enshrining the ludicrous notion that Jesus of Nazareth was really a dues-paying socialist. For a combination of good and bad reasons, Archbishop Romero of El Salvador was a man of courage and principle, in the way that some Nicaraguan base community clerics were not. The papacy put this down as a heresy. Would that it could have condemned fascism and Nazism in the same unhesitating and unambiguous tones. In a very few cases, such as Albania, communism tried to extirpate religion completely and to proclaim an entirely atheist state. This only led to even more extreme cults of mediocre human beings, such as the dictator Enver Hoxha, and to secret baptisms and ceremonies that proved the utter alienation of the common people from the regime. There is nothing in modern secular argument that even hints at any ban on religious observance. Sigmund Freud was quite right to describe the religious impulse in The Future of an Illusion as essentially ineradicable, until or unless the human species can conquer its fear of death and its tendency to wish-thinking. Neither contingency seems very probable. All that the totalitarians have demonstrated is that the religious impulse, the need to worship, can take even more monstrous forms if it is repressed. This might not necessarily be a compliment to our worshipping tendency. In the early months of this century, I made a visit to North Korea. Here, contained within a hermetic quadrilateral of territory, enclosed either by sea or by near-impenetrable frontiers, is a land entirely given over to adulation. Every waking moment of the citizen, the subject, is consecrated to praise of the Supreme Being and his Father. Every schoolroom resounds with it, every film and opera and play is devoted to it, every radio and television transmission is given up to it. So are all books and magazines and newspaper articles, all sporting events and all workplaces. I used to wonder what it would be like to have to sing everlasting praises, and now I know. Nor is the devil forgotten. The unsleeping evil of outsiders and unbelievers is warded off with a perpetual vigilance, which includes daily moments of ritual in the workplace in which hatred of the other is inculcated. The North Korean state was born at about the same time that 1984 was published, and one could almost believe that the Holy Father of the state, Kim Il-sung, was given a copy of the novel and asked if he could make it work in practice. Yet even Orwell did not dare to have it said that Big Brother's birth was attended by miraculous signs and portents, such as birds hailing the glorious event by singing in human words. Nor did the inner party of Airstrip 1 Oceania spend billions of scarce dollars at a time of horrific famine to prove that the ludicrous mammal Kim Il-sung and his pathetic mammal son Kim Jong-il were two incarnations of the same person. In this version of the Aryan heresy so much condemned by Athanasius, North Korea is unique in having a dead man as head of state. Kim Jong-il is the head of the party and the army, but the presidency is held in perpetuity by his deceased father, which makes the country a necrocracy or mausolocracy, as well as a regime that is only one figure short of a trinity. The afterlife is not mentioned in North Korea because the idea of a defection in any direction is very strongly discouraged, but as against that, it is not claimed that the two Kims will continue to dominate you after you are dead. Students of the subject can easily see that what we have in North Korea is not so much an extreme form of communism. The term is barely mentioned amid the storms of ecstatic dedication, as a debased yet refined form of Confucianism and ancestor worship. When I left North Korea, which I did with a sense of mingled relief, outrage, and pity so strong that I can still summon it, I was leaving a totalitarian state and also a religious one. I've since talked with many of the brave people who are trying to undermine this atrocious system from within and without. Let me admit at once that some of the bravest of these resistors are fundamentalist Christian anti-communists. One of these courageous men gave an interview not long ago in which he was honest enough to say that he had a difficult time preaching the idea of a savior to the half-starved and terrified few who'd managed to escape their prison state. The whole idea of an infallible and all-powerful redeemer, they said, struck them as a bit too familiar. A bowl of rice and some exposure to some wider culture, and a little relief from the hideous din of compulsory enthusiasm, would be the most they could ask for now. Those who are fortunate enough to get as far as South Korea or the United States may find themselves confronted with yet another messiah. The jailbird and tax evader Sun Myung-moon, undisputed head of the Unification Church and major contributor to the extreme right in the United States, is one of the patrons of the intelligent design racket. A leading figure of this so-called movement, and a man who never fails to award his God-man guru his proper name of Father, is Jonathan Wells, the author of a laughable anti-evolutionist diatribe entitled The Icons of Evolution. As Wells himself touchingly put it, Father's words, my studies and my prayers convinced me that I should devote my life to destroying Darwinism, just as many of my fellow unificationists had already devoted their lives to destroying Marxism. When Father chose me, along with about a dozen other seminary graduates, to enter a PhD program in 1978, I welcomed the opportunity to do battle. Mr. Wells's book is unlikely even to rate a footnote in the history of Piffle, but having seen fatherhood at work in both of the two careers, I have an idea of what the burned-over district of upstate New York must have looked and felt like when the believers had everything their own way. Religion, even at its meekest, has to admit that what it is proposing is a total solution, in which faith must be to some extent blind, and in which all aspects of the private and public life must be submitted to a permanent higher supervision. This constant surveillance and continual subjection, usually reinforced by fear in the shape of infinite vengeance, does not invariably bring out the best mammalian characteristics. It is certainly true that emancipation from religion does not always produce the best mammal either. To take two salient examples, one of the greatest and most enlightening scientists of the 20th century, J.D. Bernal, was an abject votary of Stalin and wasted much of his life defending the crimes of his leader. H.L. Mencken, one of the best satirists of religion, was too keen on Nietzsche and advocated a form of social Darwinism which included eugenics and a contempt for the weak and sick. He also had a soft spot for Adolf Hitler and wrote an unpardonably indulgent review of Mein Kampf. Humanism has many crimes for which to apologize, but it can apologize for them and also correct them in its own terms and without having to shake or challenge the basis of any unalterable system of belief. Totalitarian systems, whatever outward form they may take, are fundamentalist and, as we would now say, faith-based. In her magisterial examination of the totalitarian phenomenon, Hannah Arendt was not merely being a tribalist when she gave a special place to anti-Semitism. The idea that a group of people, whether defined as a nation or as a religion, could be condemned for all time and without the possibility of an appeal was, and is, essentially a totalitarian one. It is horribly fascinating that Hitler began by being a propagator of this deranged prejudice, and that Stalin ended by being both a victim and an advocate of it. But the virus was kept alive for centuries by religion. St. Augustine positively relished the myth of the wandering Jew, and the exile of the Jews in general, as a proof of divine justice. The Orthodox Jews are not blameless here. By claiming to be chosen in a special exclusive covenant with the Almighty, they invited hatred and suspicion and evinced their own form of racism. However, it was the secular Jews, above all, who were and are hated by the totalitarians, so no question of blaming the victim need arise. The Jesuit order, right up until the 20th century, refused by statute to admit a man unless he could prove that he had no Jewish blood for several generations. The Vatican preached that all Jews inherited the responsibility for deicide. The French Church aroused the mob against Dreyfus and the intellectuals. Islam has never forgiven the Jews for encountering Muhammad and deciding that he was not the authentic messenger. For emphasizing tribe and dynasty and racial provenance in its holy books, religion must accept the responsibility for transmitting one of mankind's most primitive illusions down through the generations. The connection between racism, religion, and totalitarianism is also to be found in the other most hateful dictatorship of the 20th century, the vile system of apartheid in South Africa. This was not just the ideology of a Dutch-speaking tribe bent on extorting forced labor from peoples of a different shade of pigmentation. It was also a form of Calvinism in practice. The Dutch Reformed Church preached as a dogma that black and white were biblically forbidden to mix, let alone to coexist in terms of equality. Racism is totalitarian by definition. It marks the victim in perpetuity and denies him or her the right to even a rag of dignity or privacy, even the elemental right to make love or marry or produce children with a loved one of the wrong tribe, without having love nullified by law. And this was the life of millions living in the Christian West in our own time. The ruling National Party, which was also heavily infected with anti-Semitism and had taken the Nazi side in the Second World War, relied on the ravings of the pulpit to justify its own blood myth of a Boer exodus that awarded it exclusive rights in a promised land. As a result, an Afrikaner permutation of Zionism created a backward and despotic state, in which the rights of all other peoples were abolished, and which eventually the survival of Afrikaners themselves was threatened by corruption, chaos, and brutality. At that point, the bovine elders of the church had a revelation which allowed the gradual abandonment of apartheid. But this can never permit forgiveness for the evil that religion did while it felt strong enough to do so. It is to the credit of many secular Christians and Jews, and many atheist and agnostic militants of the African National Congress, that South African society was saved from complete barbarism and implosion. The last century saw many other improvisations on the old idea of a dictatorship that could take care of more than merely secular or everyday problems. These ranged from the mildly offensive and insulting. The Greek Orthodox Church baptized the usurping military junta of 1967 with its eye shades and steel helmets as a Greece for Christian Greeks, to the all-enslaving Angkor of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, which sought its authority in prehistoric temples and legends. Their sometime friend and sometime rival, the aforementioned King Sihanouk, who took a playboy's refuge under the protection of the Chinese Stalinists, was also adept at being a god king when it suited him. In between lies the Shah of Iran, who claimed to be the shadow of God, as well as the light of the Aryans, and who repressed the secular opposition and took extreme care to be represented as the guardian of the Shiite shrines. His megalomania was succeeded by one of its close cousins, the Khomeiniist heresy of the Veliati Faqih, or total societal control by mullahs, who also display their deceased leader as their founder and assert that his holy words can never be rescinded. At the very extreme edge can be found the primeval Puritanism of the Taliban, which devoted itself to discovering new things to forbid, everything from music to recycled paper, which might contain a tiny fleck of pulp from a discarded Quran, and new methods of punishment, the burial alive of homosexuals. The alternative to these grotesque phenomena is not the chimera of secular dictatorship, but the defense of secular pluralism and of the right not to believe or be compelled to believe. This defense has now become an urgent and inescapable responsibility, a matter of survival. Chapter 18. A Finer Tradition. The Resistance of the Rational. I am thus one of the very few examples in this country of one who has not thrown off religious belief, but never had it. This point in my early education had, however, incidentally, one bad consequence, deserving notice. In giving me an opinion contrary to that of the world, my father thought it necessary to give it as one which could not prudently be avowed to the world. This lesson of keeping my thoughts to myself, at that early age, was attended with some moral disadvantages. John Stuart Mill, Autobiography. Le silence éternel de ces espaces infinis m'effraie. The eternal silence of these infinite spaces makes me afraid. Blaise Pascal, Pensée. The Book of Psalms can be deceiving. The celebrated opening of Psalm 121, for example, I shall lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help, is rendered in English as a statement, but in the original takes the form of a question. Where is the help coming from? Never fear, the glib answer is that the believers will be immune from all danger and suffering. Whoever the psalmist turns out to have been, he was obviously pleased enough with the polish and address of Psalm 14 to repeat it virtually word for word as Psalm 53. Both versions begin with the identical statement that the fool has said in his heart there is no God. For some reason, this null remark is considered significant enough to be recycled throughout all religious apologetics. All that we can tell for sure from the otherwise meaningless assertion is that unbelief, not just heresy and backsliding, but unbelief, must have been known to exist even in that remote epoch. Given the then absolute rule of unchallenged and brutally punitive faith, it would perhaps have been a fool who did not keep this conclusion buried deep inside himself, in which case it would be interesting to know how the psalmist knew it was there. Dissidents used to be locked up in Soviet lunatic asylums for reformist delusions, it being quite naturally and reasonably assumed that anybody mad enough to propose reforms had lost all sense of self-preservation. Our species will never run out of fools, but I dare say that there have been at least as many credulous idiots who professed faith in God as there have been dolts and simpletons who concluded otherwise. It might be immodest to suggest that the odds rather favour the intelligence and curiosity of the atheists, but it is the case that some humans have always noticed the improbability of God, the evil done in his name, the likelihood that he is man-made, and the availability of less harmful alternative beliefs and explanations. We cannot know the names of all these men and women because they have, in all times and at all places, been subject to ruthless repression. For the identical reason, nor can we know how many ostensibly devout people were secretly unbelievers. As late as the 18th and 19th centuries, in relatively free societies such as Britain and the United States, unbelievers as secure and prosperous as James Mill and Benjamin Franklin felt it advisable to keep their opinions private. Thus, when we read of the glories of Christian devotional painting and architecture, or Islamic astronomy and medicine, we are talking about advances of civilization and culture, some of them anticipated by Aztecs and Chinese, that have as much to do with faith as their predecessors had to do with human sacrifice and imperialism. And we have no means of knowing, except in a very few special cases, how many of these architects and painters and scientists were preserving their innermost thoughts from the scrutiny of the godly. Galileo might have been unmolested in his telescopic work if he had not been so unwise as to admit that it had cosmological implications. Doubt, scepticism, and outright unbelief have always taken the same essential form as they do today. There were always observations on the natural order which took notice of the absence or needlessness of a prime mover. There were always shrewd comments on the way in which religion reflected human wishes or human designs. It was never that difficult to see that religion was a cause of hatred and conflict, and that its maintenance depended upon ignorance and superstition. Satirists and poets, as well as philosophers and men of science, were capable of pointing out that if triangles had gods, their gods would have three sides, just as Thracian gods had blonde hair and blue eyes. The original collision between our reasoning faculties and any form of organized faith, though it must have occurred before in the minds of many, is probably exemplified in the trial of Socrates in 399 BC. It does not matter at all to me that we have no absolute certainty that Socrates even existed. The records of his life and his words are second-hand, almost, but not quite as much, as are the books of the Jewish and Christian Bible and the Hadiths of Islam. Philosophy, however, has no need of such demonstrations because it does not deal in revealed wisdom. As it happens, we have some plausible accounts of the life in question. A Stoic soldier, somewhat resembling Schweik in appearance, a shrewish wife, a tendency to attacks of catalepsy, and these will do. On the word of Plato, who was perhaps an eyewitness, we may accept that during a time of paranoia and tyranny in Athens, Socrates was indicted for godlessness and knew his life to be forfeit. The noble words of the apology also make it plain that he did not care to save himself by affirming, like a later man faced with an inquisition, anything that he did not believe. Even though he was not in fact an atheist, he was quite correctly considered unsound for his advocacy of free thought and unrestricted inquiry, and his refusal to give assent to any dogma. All he really knew, he said, was the extent of his own ignorance. This, to me, is still the definition of an educated person. According to Plato, this great Athenian was quite content to observe the customary rites of the city, testified that the Delphic oracle had instructed him to become a philosopher, and on his deathbed, condemned to swallow the hemlock, spoke of a possible afterlife in which those who had thrown off the world by mental exercise might yet continue to lead an existence of pure mind. But even then he remembered, as always, to qualify himself by adding that this might well not be the case. The question, as always, was worth pursuing. Philosophy begins where religion ends, just as by analogy chemistry begins where alchemy runs out and astronomy takes the place of astrology. From Socrates also we can learn how to argue two things that are of the highest importance. The first is that conscience is innate. The second is that the dogmatic faithful can easily be outpointed and satirized by one who pretends to take their preachings at face value. Socrates believed that he had a daemon, or oracle, or internal guide whose good opinion was worth having. Everybody but the psychopath has this feeling to a greater or lesser extent. Adam Smith described a permanent partner in an inaudible conversation who acted as a check and scrutineer. Sigmund Freud wrote that the voice of reason was small but very persistent. C.S. Lewis tried to prove too much by opining that the presence of a conscience indicated the divine spark. Modern vernacular describes conscience not too badly as whatever it is that makes us behave well when nobody's looking. At any event, Socrates absolutely refused to say anything of which he was not morally sure. He would sometimes, if he suspected himself of casuistry or crowd-pleasing, break off in the very middle of a speech. He told his judges that at no point in his closing plea had his oracle hinted at him to stop. Those who believe that the existence of conscience is a proof of a godly design are advancing an argument that simply cannot be disproved because there is no evidence for or against it. The case of Socrates, however, demonstrates that men and women of real conscience will often have to assert it against faith. He was facing death but had the option, even if convicted, of a lesser sentence if he chose to plead for it. In almost insulting tones, he offered to pay a negligible